I got a shrapnel ball in my left knee. There wasn't a spoonful of blood when I was wounded, and there was very little pain. All our transport had disappeared, even the Red Cross vans. Eventually, I got away with an artillery lorry to a little field station where I got a dressing. Then I walked as far to the rear as I could. In a couple of hours, my leg had swollen up enormously. It was 4 days before I got any proper dressing for my leg, by which time gangrene had set in. They took the bullet out at a field station. "Do anything," I told them, "but you don't want to take my leg off, do you?" They said it might well come to that, so they needed my permission. I said to go ahead. They knew better than I did. I never dreamed of losing a leg. At first, they cut a big slit along the front and along the side of my leg to let the bad blood out, and I thought that would cure it. I didn't even think it would be enough to keep me away from the war, but it proved otherwise. I had the operation to remove the leg, and then after 10 days, I came back to England. I went from a healthy lad to a shadow, and I lost my hair. The first time I was fitted with an artificial leg, I was at Roehampton for 6 weeks until they made the leg, and then I had to practice walking on it. When I first got it, I thought, if I walk 100 yards with this, I'll deserve a Victoria Cross. But I went home a week later, and the next day I went for a cycle ride, but I was only a lad then. It was 38 years before I had the stump re-sewn, but I have a wonderful stump now. I know how long it was because I was attending a limb fitting hospital in Leeds. The surgeon never saw your leg. He saw you with a wooden or metal leg on, and if you walked all right, he'd not bother to examine your stump. I used to play golf. I drove a car, an ordinary one without any special fittings. Even though I have only a very short stump, I use my artificial leg for the clutch. I lost my wife after 58 years and I remarried the most wonderful woman in the world. An absolute marvel. She encouraged me to go to Leeds and asked to try on one of these new suction end legs. I saw a doctor and he was a treasure. He said, "Try it by all means. It's wonderful at nearly 90 to want to try something new." I got this new leg. It was all plastic and padding. I found it bulky and I couldn't sit with my legs crossed. And I thought it would be a lot lighter, but it wasn't due to all the padding. So I went back to the old one. It's never got me down, my leg. I've never felt sorry for myself. I've always thought about what I've got, not what I'd lost. I still think the same way. I've been blind for 15 years, but I don't think I've ever complained once. I lost my hearing, which was absolutely acute. And I still have a shocking cough from the gas. They never gave me any allowance for the effects of the gas. If I'd had four toes off, I would have got 4 shillings a week less in my pension than I did for losing my leg. There isn't a happier man in the world than me today, and there isn't a happier woman than my wife. She lost her husband about 10 years ago, and they'd been friends of ours before my first wife died. It isn't much good being on your own when you can't see, and I had to go to a home for limbless ex-servicemen. All the same, I rang her up every day for about 5 years, and she said it helped keep her reason after she'd lost her husband. We were always great friends before, and I never stopped ringing her each morning. She's told me since we got married that she used to look forward to this. She used to come and get meals ready for me, and I got very fond of her. I said to her that if I was 15 years younger, I'd ask her to marry me. She said that's the way she felt about me. If I needed nursing, she'd want to nurse me. So we got married. And it's the most wonderful thing that has ever happened. That's quite a moving and lovely story told by a veteran from the Great War, a man called Private Harry Davis, who was wounded while serving with the 8th Battalion of the Black Watch. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week it's stories like that that I wanted to feature on for the next hour or so. These are the lives that were changed forever because of what happened in the Great War, the aftermath of the war. And as usual, we're going to tell their stories through their own words. We're going to find out what happened to these boys and how they coped. In some cases, they didn't cope at all after what they'd experienced. Sometimes these boys served all 4 years on the Western Front, like my granddad. In other cases, it was just a few weeks or even less, but it still changed their lives forever, as we'll see. But before we go on to do that, I wanted to give a plug out to a new page that I've set up on the social media platform called Facebook, which I'm sure a lot of you will be on. I've created a Tales from the Battlefields page on Facebook, and the idea is that I'll be obviously promoting Tales from the Battlefields on that page, but I'll also be including some stories that are perhaps not relevant for the podcast, those that involve showing photos that I've discovered along the way, and I'll also share details of some of the tours and talks that I do as part of my retirement. As you know, this is a retirement hobby for me. And of course, we'll be talking about the work of the Army Benevolent Fund, who produce this podcast for me, and they are my great passion, raising funds for the soldiers and veterans and their families of today. So if you go over to Facebook and type in Tales from the Battlefield podcast, you'll find the page and you can join it. And you can also put your own comments on there, your own stories on there, and ideas for the podcast as well. I'll be very grateful to hear any ideas and suggestions that you may have. Any feedback that I get is always very, very welcome. So let's start by listening to the words of a man called Joseph Pickard, who had been serving with the Northumberland Fusiliers during the war. And he was seriously wounded in the leg, and shrapnel had sliced through his sciatic nerve, chipping both of his hip joints. It smashed the left side of his pelvis, and he says it made three holes in his bladder, and he lost his nose. Shell blast blew his nose off. He said, "What a bloody mess." He said, "I crawled along on my hands and knees, and I saw a fellow I knew, and I shouted out to him, and someone got a stretcher, and there was a Red Cross van piled up near the bottom of the road. They carried me through the barrage, and I got into a wagon. And one fellow said, 'You'll be all right now, chum.' And then he lost consciousness, and he woke up in an advanced dressing station, lying on a stretcher. He'd been left for dead. The blanket was all over him. Back home, his wife was informed that he'd indeed died, as did his parents, but his mother didn't believe it. Apparently his mum was baking bread when the telegram came. She just set it aside, and when someone asked her about it, she said, 'No, it's not true.' And it wasn't true. He was in fact alive, just about. Eventually, after a lot of treatment, he returned home to the northeast of England. He lived in Alnwick. And he tried to describe what it was like to be without a nose. He said, 'I'll never put the bandages back on my face. I've got a bit of plastic to put across the hole where my nose had been.' But that's enough of me trying to explain what it was like. Let's hear the words of Joseph Pickard himself, recorded during an interview with the Imperial War Museum.
Though I could never run with this leg, I could never run. And I couldn't do very much in the sporting line. I couldn't. Impossible. It was only once, and it was before I got the nose put on, when I was down in Wales, and I think it was the first time I was ever out of the hospital. And I wanted to go down and have a look at the place. It's a place, something similar to Alnwick. It's got a square and, you know, and all that sort of thing. Then it had. I mean, I talk about things as if it was the same as what it was. But anyhow, it's all the houses are built on a hillside, in rows, you see. And I was going along the bottom, and there's some kids in sort of playing about in the bottoms of the things. And as I went past, a short time after they got up, and they galloped past me, you see. I passed about two or three streets, and when I got there, I saw all the kids in the blinking neighbourhood had gathered.
Staring.
Talking, looking, gawping at me. Because I still had this thing, you see. I never used to bother.
The card thing?
The little bit of plastic stuff or whatever it was.
Blocking.
White stuff. You can transparent, nearly. And I could have taken the crutch and hit the whole blinking lot of them. I knew what they were looking at. So I turned around and I went back to the hospital. Talk about confidence. I turned straight around and went back. So I was sitting one day and I thought, well, it's no good. I can stop like this for the rest of my life. I said, you've got to face it sometime. So I went out again. After that, I just walked out. And people staring. And if it got bad, I used to turn around and look at them.
We'll be hearing much more from Joseph later as he explains what happened to him in later life. We find out Harry managed to get a job with the help of the War Office and the government. Harry dealt with going back into civilian life after being demobbed. And that leg of his that had been so badly wounded, would you believe, he hurt it again very badly in the 1950s. He'll tell us how that happened later on. So what I've done now is to go through some newspaper articles from the 1920s and try to find out what had happened to some of these men that are perhaps unheard of, that not been, their stories had not been told before. This is what this podcast is all about. I wanted to discover some new and unusual stories about these boys that had served on the Western Front during the Great War. And to be honest, some of these stories that I've found are almost beyond belief. In my own small mind, I thought that when November 1918 came, these men returned to their homes, to their jobs, that their wounds repaired, and they got on with life. They went back to their families. Nothing could be further from the truth. How could anything be normal again after the trauma, even those that were unwounded? They'd seen things that couldn't be unseen. They'd seen things that we can't begin to understand. And some of these stories that I'm going to tell now demonstrate those points that I've just made. They also demonstrate how far from the truth my understanding was as I grew up, surrounded in the 70s, especially by these men. We used to wander around the streets of Northampton, the parks of Northampton, and it wasn't unusual to see someone without an arm or a leg. Took no notice of them, really. Well, let's find out now, shall we, what was happening to some of these guys. The first story that I've got for you is an incredible tale, really, a very short tale. And it concerns a man called Frederick Holman of Stony Stratford in Buckinghamshire. Such was his shell shock, his post-traumatic stress, when he came back from the war in 1918. He'd been unable to speak properly. He could only whisper, and his family couldn't understand what he was saying. He'd got a wife and a baby, and that young baby had never heard him speak. But he got a dog, and one day he was trying to train the dog. He was telling the dog to lie down, and he got frustrated with it. So he shouted at the dog, "Lie down!" And guess what? It worked. The dog heard him and lay down. His wife and child had heard his voice, and it cured him. He suddenly got his voice back, and let's hope that Frederick Holmes lived a relatively normal way of life after that. 10 years after the armistice, it's 1928, and still the memories of the Great War were never far away. The Northampton local newspaper said that tomorrow is the great day of remembrance when we pause to keep in dear memory the men, women and boys who fell or were grievously wounded in the Great War. We may remove the great guns, but such things are written in the following lines by a Miss Powell will never be put entirely away. I don't know how old Miss Powell was, but this is what she wrote. She said, an open drawer, a woman lowly kneeling. Some crimson shoes, a lock of hair, some childish toys, an engine and a trumpet, a headless horse, a tattered teddy bear, some schoolboy books, all inky, torn and thumb-marked, a treasured bat, his favourite cricket ball, the things he loved, the letters that he wrote her. And now she places on top of all a soldier's sword, his photograph in khaki. The boyish eyes smile back into her eyes, and in her heart, a grave in Flanders lies. As I say, I don't know who Miss Powell was. I don't know who she's writing about. Maybe it was her loved one. But those words are really describing a mother's memories. looking at that rocking horse, a teddy bear, the schoolboy books. No doubt up and down the country and beyond into Europe, to our enemy countries even. For decades, families would have treasured those keepsakes. It was their tangible way of keeping in touch with those boys that would never come home. There would be an empty chair. It was a way for the families to have some tangible contact with the boys that perhaps have a grave, as she said, in Flanders, or maybe didn't. They were one of the missing. But all the time they'd got his favourite cricket ball, the things that he loved, those letters that they wrote home, all the time they had that. That was a way of staying in contact with the boys that never returned to that empty chair at mealtime. This next article I discovered in the Army and Navy Gazette, dated 30th of April 1921, so 2.5 years after the armistice. And it's a short article, but quite angry about how it felt the country was dealing with the wounded men that had come back from the war. It says, "Not before it was time has an association been formed, the object of which is the continuance to those men wounded in the war who were still in their thousands, inmates or outpatients of our hospitals." And it describes, this article describes how finally an organisation, which was called the Not Forgotten Association, had been set up to help the men continue with their recovery from their wounds in the Great War. It says that there are still thousands of inmates or outpatients of the hospitals, and many people seem to have formed the comfortable belief that with the close of the war, there equally and automatically came to an end all the suffering that it had caused, that the wounded were healed and left their hospitals, and there was no further need to offer them those little kindnesses which cost so small a sum and which mean so much to the man in blue. It says that there are at present more than 10,000 men in hospital in the London region alone. And of late, the number of people who have helped to take any of these forgotten wounded out on motor car trips, to teas and concerts, amounts to 16 individuals. It was indeed time that the Not Forgotten Association was founded, and it is devoutly to be hoped that the number of his associates will increase, for there is abundant room for almost any number of helpers to visit, entertain and take for drives those wounded and very lonely soldiers. More lonely, perhaps, than ever before, as day by day they see their comrades leave the hospitals on regaining health while they remain behind. Offers of help should be sent to the Honourable Secretary at 86 Ladbroke Road, London, W11. I wonder whether it worked. Now, whenever we do a battlefield tour on the Western Front, one of the first things we always do is to warn people that the iron harvest is still coming through, especially when the fields have been ploughed. It's not uncommon to see unexploded shells or hand grenades lying by the side of a farm track, sometimes marked with colours by the farmer so that the authorities can come round and pick them up and take them away. And this next short story tells us the danger of these war relics. This article is dated 1921 and concerns two women from Canterbury in Kent, Mary Wise and Emily Price. Well, a soldier of their acquaintance had brought back one of those Mills hand grenades from the Western Front. As a war souvenir, they thought it was harmless and they used it as an ornament. But it was forgotten about and it was left in the fireplace. And when winter came, the fire was lit. Well, you can guess what happened next. There was an explosion which wrecked the room and injured both women in the legs. Right, I think it's time that we heard a bit more from our friend Joseph Pickard. He now talks about going before the medical boards who assessed his wounds and how the government helped him to get a job in a watch factory.
I never used to mention it. I never used to talk about it. And I find gradually, if you're not the one that talks about what's the matter with you, nobody would be bothered with it. Well, I came back, it must have been 21, and I wasn't back 2 or 3 weeks. I got a notice of a board, a medical board, in Newcastle. And my right joint, the right hip, had been bothering me for a while. God, it was all colours of the blinking rainbow. It just must have been a shock on the burn or something. Anyhow, I went up. And I went to the board and went in. There were generally about three or four doctors on the board. And I asked you this and asked you that. As soon as I walked in, the fella says, "What are you doing here?" He says, "You should be in hospital." I said, "Good Lord," I said, "I've only just come out." Brazen lie. I was going back there. I asked to get out of Sitka. The doctor would have kept us there. I said, no, I've been here long enough. I said, "I've got to start another life once I get out." I said, "I'm not like you, you've got all that you made up."
In 1928, the Menin Gate in Ypres had only recently been opened, and 500 Scottish pilgrims attended the service that no doubt many of you have been to, and I've been to, of course, at the last post at the Menin Gate. Now, I don't know whether drink was involved, but one of those Scotsmen was called Alexander Scott from Galashiels. He'd been badly wounded at Ypres, and he managed to find the location of the trench where he'd received what he called his blighty wound. But he fell into the trench. Accidentally, he says. His leg was severely twisted, and he had to be taken back to Glasgow, where he was admitted to a hospital and he had to recover. So Alexander Scott had been wounded twice in the Ypres salient in exactly the same place, 11 years apart. I wonder if he went back a third time. A land fit for heroes was supposed to be the promise, or was the promise made to the veterans when they returned home after the armistice. But there are countless records and examples of how the veterans found this not to be the case. There are so many stories of them left destitute, selling matchsticks on street corners, the pension having run out. And here I found a really sad story, which is probably quite common of its time, dated 1923 in Croydon in Surrey, in the south of England. Newspaper article says, "Hungry and desperate plea of a wounded ex-soldier arrested at Norbury." The article tells us that the man arrested was Charles Reed, who the paper said was an emaciated-looking man of no fixed abode. He was brought before the Croydon Borough Justice on Saturday morning and charged with being a suspected person found loitering on enclosed premises for the purpose of committing a felony. The arresting officer said that he saw the prisoner in the vicinity of Pollard Hill at 1 a.m. He was peering into the front gardens of several houses, and the witness kept him under observation and saw him go into London Road. He ran up a gap by the Norbury Estate Office and the witness followed. The policeman said to Reed, "What are you doing here?" And the prisoner replied, "I'm going to try and get in. I'm hungry and I'm desperate." The police officer arrested him, and on the way to the police station, Reed said to the police officer, "I'm an ex-soldier. I was wounded in the war and my pension has been stopped. My home is in Manchester and I'm down and out." When the charge was read to him at the police station, Reed said, "Yes, that is right. I'm fed up." He was remanded in custody for a week to await inquiries. I don't know what the outcome was. So after all that misery, I think we ought to hear a bit of a good story. This one is dated 1921, and again, I think it's a situation that's not unusual, probably not encouraged by the military authorities at the time, but it must have happened a lot, mustn't it? A happy ending to a war romance. Montrose girl weds in Sydney, Australia. The happy ending to a war romance, which began in a hospital somewhere in France, has a particular interest for Montrosians. Miss Bessie Gordon, daughter of the late Mr. Alan Gordon and Mrs. Gordon, has been married in Sydney to Mr. Frederick Albert Lungley. Immediately on the arrival of the ship which carried her across the seas to her bridegroom, the bridesmaid at the wedding ceremony was an Australian nursing sister who worked alongside the bride attending the wounded during the war days. The bridegroom is a prosperous sheep farmer, and the happy lovers, now united in wedlock, are spending their honeymoon in and around Sydney. On the 31st of July 1917, the Welsh Regiment, having recovered from the mauling they got on the Somme the year before, were involved in the successful first day of the Third Battle of Ypres, the Battle of Passchendaele, when they charged the German positions on the Pilcombe Ridge. If you go to that location now, you've got the Welsh Dragon, a replica of the one that's near Mehmet's Wood. That marks the spot where those Welshmen achieved so much success on the first day of that momentous battle. And there was an officer that day that was wounded in the right arm. All we know that his name was Lieutenant Griffiths. And he was helped by a private called Louis Wilde. Louis managed to take the officer to a first aid post. And after his wound had been dressed, he shook hands with him and said to Wilde, "So long, we may not meet again, but I will not forget you." And that was it. As far as Wilde was concerned, that was the end of the story. Until 1929, 12 years after that incident, when Louis, now back home in Blackwood in Monmouthshire, working back in the mines, received the most unexpected letter. When he opened the letter, he was amazed to discover that he'd been left the incredible sum of £8,563 in the will. And who had left that money for him but the officer that he'd helped to that dressing station at Passchendaele all those years before? Wilde told the local newspaper, "I met the principal of the tracing agents at Newport, and at first he bewildered me by asking if I remembered any outstanding incidents during the war. He said, I served in France from February 1916 to the end of the war, first in the Cardiff City Battalion, then in the 16th and later in the 9th. He said, I was wounded in October of 1917 and I was in hospital for 5 months before I returned to France. My reply to his question was that I did not. He then asked me if I remembered a certain officer who he described. And I said that I remembered a short, dark officer, Lieutenant Griffiths. A further question put to me was, do you remember doing any special kindness for him? And then he did. He remembered helping that officer to the dressing station and his words, "I will not forget you." Since that day, Wilde said, I've neither seen him nor heard from him. The principal says, well, I've got a pleasant surprise for you. There's a sum of 8,563, which I believe has been left to you by the officer in his will. You can only imagine Wilde's reaction to that. He says, the two gentlemen called at my house when I was at work and my wife was out, and I anticipate that I shall receive a cheque shortly. Wilde come from a family of six children, four of whom are boys. He was a married man, and he'd got a son himself, 7 years of age. £8,500 in 1929 was a hell of a lot of money. I'm not sure what that equates to now, but as he and his family had worked down the mines of South Wales, it must have had a massive impact on that man's life. I wonder what became of him. But that's a great story to share, isn't it? In that same year of 1929, a couple of hundred miles north in the county of Staffordshire, there was to be an event that was almost the complete opposite. There was a married couple called Samuel and Annie Morrissey. Annie had been married twice before she met Samuel, but both of her husbands had died during the Great War. She got a daughter aged 17 from her first marriage. And between her and Samuel, they'd got two more children aged 9 and 5. Samuel, who was 33 years old, had joined up at the beginning of the war, as so many did. And just before the Battle of the Somme, in June of 1916, he was wounded and returned home to England and never did go back to the war because he was suffering with shell shock. 13 years later, there was a double tragedy. Samuel locked himself and Annie in the kitchen of their home in Longton, near Stoke-on-Trent. He killed her and then he cut his own throat. A report says there was a bloodstained razor lying nearby. Not only had Samuel never recovered from his shell shock, he'd found it difficult to hold down a job. He was a miner, like so many of them. And most of that time after the war, he'd been unemployed. And then one day he's just cracked. Once again, you wonder what happened to those three children that were left behind. One of those children in recent years, erected a headstone above what was previously an unmarked grave. Of course, it's not a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone because he died 8 years after the cut-off date. There's a black headstone which simply says, "In memory of my dear parents, Samuel and Annie." At the foot of the headstone is a bunch of orange roses. That's more evidence that the Great War was still causing many more casualties years, decades later. Poor Annie, how much she had suffered. She herself, of course, indirectly becomes another casualty of the war. I've got a photograph of both Samuel and Annie that I found on ancestry.co.uk, and also a photograph of the grave that I just talked about. I'll put those on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk, and I'll also put them on the Tales from the Battlefields Facebook page that I mentioned at the beginning of this episode. For years after the war, as we heard earlier, many of these veterans were still in hospital, and one of them was a man called Frederick Boxall, who'd been wounded in the war and was still in hospital in London, in Bloomsbury, where he was suffering from shell shock. And this is in 1923, so 5 years after the guns had stopped firing. But he was still suffering badly. And again, one night, he just lost it. Still in his pyjamas, he left his bed. He rushed out into the corridor. He was followed by one of the staff members. She seized him by the sleeve as he climbed up into a window. But the material gave way and Boxall fell into the yard below. He wasn't killed, but he got a fractured skull and other injuries, and he died 2 hours later at the inquest. There was a verdict of suicide whilst of unsound mind, another victim of the Great War. How many more are there that we don't know about? In Christmas 1931, an ex-officer of the British Expeditionary Force announced to the local newspaper in Bristol that he'd like to present a Christmas hamper to the first, as he called it, war croc, so the first man wounded in the Great War. And he put a date of August the 27th. He wanted to hear from men that had been wounded before that and try and establish who the first one was that was wounded, and that person was going to get a hamper from this unnamed ex-officer. He'd received nearly 150 letters from men in all parts of the country, and many of them, 17 years after being wounded, were still suffering. Many of them had been wounded during the Battle of Mons and during the fighting retreat that went on for the next 2 weeks. But it wasn't a soldier that he established was the first man to be wounded, but a sailor, a stoker called J.M. Dale from Gillingham in Kent, and he was wounded on HMS Lark on the 6th of August 1914, so just 2 days after the outbreak of the war. HMS Amphion had struck a German mine and HMS Lark went to the rescue of the survivors. Dale was then hit when the shells and torpedo tubes of HMS Lark exploded during the rescue work, and he states that he was the first sailor conveyed to hospital with war wounds and was complimented by the King on this fact. So the hamper was sent off to Mr. Dale, who was unemployed but had a family of 5 small children. He must have had a wonderful Christmas. But the officer that made that kind gesture was quite upset by some of the letters that he received, which he says were pitiful. He says it's not been possible to distinguish between several rival claims by men of the old contemptibles. But thanks to the generosity of Messrs. Cross and Blackwell, who supplied me with a hamper for Stoker Dale, 10 Mons heroes are to have a far merrier Christmas than they would otherwise have had. Each of them will receive a consolation hamper, which has been dispatched. The ex-officer said that many of the letters reaching him from men disabled in the first fighting in the war made pathetic reading. He was going to refer the most urgent cases to some of the organisations which looked after ex-soldiers. If there were any people able to help, he would be glad if they would write to him at 20 Soho Square. The problem, of course, was vast. Perhaps he didn't realise that until he made that kind offer. And the problem didn't go away. As we know, many of these veterans suffered for the rest of their natural lives. So what about Joseph Pickard? What was he doing? Well, in 1922, he was finally well enough to return to civilian life. He was determined that he wasn't going to be an invalid, and he wanted to live the most normal life that he could. Let's pick up his story again, shall we, through his own words.
And I thought, well, I was thinking all the time, what the devil will I do? I'm not going to be like some of them, walk the street with a stick or something like that and get, you know, and live, try to live on a pension and all this sort of thing. So I found out what the government was able to do. And I found they had a, what they call an instructional factory at Birtley, that's in Durham. So there was a list of things you could go in for, all sorts of things, tailoring, cobbling, I couldn't fancy that either. But, anyhow, I mean, I've been on a lathe and sort of used my fingers before, early on, you see, but anyhow, I thought, if I go for watchmaking, I can sit down. I couldn't stand at the bench, you see, that was my trouble. And I got an invite up to Newcastle, and I had to go in front of a board of watchmakers, people that had shops up in Newcastle, and sort of ask you what you wanted to be that for. Let's have a look at your fingers, and I'll got all this sort of business. And the next thing, I got invited to start at Bortley, and there was instructors there, like supervisors, foremen or something like that. There was three different shops. You started as a, like an apprentice would, with a file and a square and a block of oak. And you had to square, it was a hacked out of a piece of wood, and you had to square that piece of oak. That was the start. Didn't matter which way the square went on, it had to be there.
So this factory was run by the government. Was it specially for veterans?
Yes, all ex-soldiers.
Was it for any veteran, or was it specifically for wounded veterans?
No, if anybody had been in the army, or the forces rather. There was a guardsman there, we used to call him Pansy. He called him darling, and he used to answer it. It was just as good as a bag home.
Pickard, if you remember, had suffered a serious wound to his leg. And nearly 40 years after the initial injury, would you believe, he wounded it again.
And I slipped on the Sunday afternoon on black ice in January 54, and I smashed this leg.
Bad leg again.
And I went to Ashington Hospital. I was on my back for 12 months. Got the bad leg, bad mend. And I was still another 18 months with a long caliper on. And still I didn't walk. And when I finished, I thought, beyond place, we're walking for the bus, I'll start for myself. So I did. I finished up with my own workshop.
So these lads and their families at home suffered long, long beyond the end of the war. Something that I think we should think about. And we are doing, of course, by listening to this podcast today. Recently, I read in less than a couple of hours a book written by the author of the famous novel Tarka the Otter, Henry Williamson. Talked about him before on the podcast. And he returned to the battlefields a decade or so later. And he recorded his thoughts in a book that he called The Wet Flanders Plain. The bit that I want to read to you now doesn't come from Ypres. It comes from the Somme, the valley of the Ancre. He says, "My comrades died in the cellars and rubble of this town." I think he's talking about Albert, which was destroyed and made fetid by the German guns away over the hills, enclosing the marshy valley. I arrived at the Estaminet as twilight was closing, the day of wind and rain, the grey battlefield rain that used to make one ear of a mule droop lower and lower. And when the other ear had drooped beside it, then the poor donk was liable to sink down to rise no more out of the knee-deep mud. It was not pleasant, this new Estaminet. The floor was of composition made to look like marble. The mirrors behind the bar had the tawdriness of a new factory-made things. The oak panels of the chair backs were of American press paper. However, here I would stay for the night and leave the rain and the darkness outside. The landlord was suspicious. Why did I walk in the rain without a coat? Hadn't I got a coat? Did I come from back home, where perhaps I'd been seeking work like so many others in the brick factory? What had I got in my pack? Had I money for a bed? I longed to curse him violently, as once a colonel leading his battalion out of the line to rest had cursed me when my horse bumped into him during the nightly transport congestion. I showed the landlord my money, the dirty, creased, tattered paper money of the district. It satisfied him, and he invited me to drink and dance. There were Italian plasterers in the throng who were earning, I learned, from 40 to 80 francs a day. I could not enter into their fun. I was entirely a foreigner among the living, and half a foreigner to myself. A man who had lost part of himself, and was now beginning to find it again. For the years, the lost part had lurked in the marsh, seeing wraiths of men in grey with coal-scuttle helmets and big boots, wraiths of men in khaki, always laden and toiling, wraiths of depressed mules, sick with fatigue and mud rash, walking in long files up to the field guns, wraiths of howitzers flashing away their shells with stupendous corkscrewing hisses upwards, rays of pallid flares making the night haggard, while bullets whined and fell with short, hard splashes in the shadowy and gleaming swamps of the Onc. I could not sleep in my damp bed. The moonlight in the open window showed the dark patches on the ceiling under the leaking roof, the plastered walls, the floorboards bare of carpet or any furniture. The dancers seemed to be walking about in the road all night, but at 2 o'clock it ceased. The last unsteady steps and confused voices went away down the brick rubble road, and I heard the frogs in the swamp again. Still I could not sleep. Was there a demon influence in the marsh, materialising out of the harsh, ceaseless croaking amongst the stumps of the dead poplars? The restless spirits of old cruelty and hate and despair wandering among the reedy shell holes, among the crumbling wheels of sunken guns and the brown wire in the long grass. The young green had grown again, hiding the old bitterness, but the desolation was still there. No white gun flashes lit the walls of the room. The trains from Lille to Amiens rolled noisily past the window. A star moved steadily across the curtain space, seeming to look into the room curiously. When it became very lonely there, and glimpses of the past returned with unveiling sadness. The dugouts of Y Ravine had subsided. The dry rotted timbers broke with a touch. The pistons and main shaft and cylinders of the aeroplane rusted in the grasses. I remembered the charred framework of the ridge above Station Road, with rifle barrels and holed helmets and burst Minnenwaffe cases. Those dreaded oil drums of the minis. Rust and mildew and long tangled grass and frogs. The Onc flowed in its chalky bed, swift and cold as before, gathering its green duckweed into a heaving coat as of mail and drowning the white flowers of Waters Crowsfoot. Only one thing of our work remained, the wooden military bridge over the mill causeway. When I awoke next morning, the wraiths were fled, but the grey rain still drifted across the downs. What was to be found in the valley then? For we put into things what we feel, and if we feel nothing, then there is nothing. I was filled with longing for my home, to see again the lanes, the sea, the barns, the hills, the eyes of my wife, the smile of my little boy listening to the bells on the wind of heaven, the new part of myself overlaying the wraith of that lost forever. There's another book that I highly recommend to you, and it's called Into Battle, A Soldier's Diary of the Great War, written by a man called John Glubb. He kept a diary, and I turned to the end of the book for his closing comments. He said, in 1919, I went up to London to watch the Victory March, when the army marched through London. So much hardship, so much courage, so much comradeship, so much heroism, and now such overwhelming glory. I'm only 21, but I feel that the crisis of my life is past. Anything which happens to me after this can be no more than an anticlimax. And then he rolls the clock forward to 1977, when the book was published. He said many of the officers, NCOs and men of the 7th Company wrote to me after return to England, and some continued to do so for many years. Corporal Rennie, who was much older than me, died many years ago. Sergeant Adams, who was with me in Sanctuary Wood, kept in touch with me until he died 3 years ago. The last of them was Driver Clement, who became a postmaster in Yorkshire. He kept bees on the moors, and every year at Christmas he used to send me a present of honey, and continued to do so until he died in 1975. Nearly 60 years since we had been together in France. Such were the comradeships of the Great War. But I think what we need to do is to give the final word to our friend Joseph Pickard, a man having listened to much of his interview with the Imperial War Museum. I feel as though I've got to know, even though, of course, I didn't meet him. He died, I think he lived until he was in his 90s, died in 1991. These are his thoughts on his role in the Great War.
Oh, it's hard to tell. Maybe a certain amount of satisfaction. It's hard to explain. I was determined to go. I was glad I went. I've never complained about being in the war. Made as a man. Because I was standing on my feet at the time I was 15 and a half. Amongst men. You had to stand up for yourself. I had me fights. When I was 15, I came out and I didn't care a hoot for who was speaking to us and who wasn't speaking to us. I've said it before, I've never regret anything in my life except the death of my wife. That's the only thing I regret. I don't care about anything else. I've had 33 operations. I was away last year. Where up till I got discharged the 1st of September. I got hit with some hemorrhages, and they couldn't clear them. And I went back. They went back to treatment of 1918. The treatment I had then, they had to give us then last year to start it off, to get rid of all this clotted blood and whatnot. Well, you see, I had a job, and I had a wage. I don't suppose it affected us all that much. My wife got all my wages. I lived on my pension. Backing horses, playing cards. I went back to it. And I didn't do so badly over the... So I was satisfied.
We can see from the stories that I've told this week that the veterans' stories after the guns stopped firing were varied, as you'd expect. Some were tragic, some were happy. I suppose many were somewhere in between. But I called this episode Lives Change Forever. And for all of the combatants on the Western Front and beyond, of course their lives will never be the same again. How could they be? But in my mind's eye, when I tried to think about how to end this podcast, I could see these boys marching what are now down quiet country lanes on the Somme, singing songs like this one. Thank you for listening.
Up to mighty London came an Irishman one day. As the streets were paved with gold, sure everyone was gay. Singing songs of Piccadilly, Strand and Leicester Square, till Paddy got excited and he shouted to them there. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my Irish money, oh. Say it should you not receive it right and let me know. If I make mistakes in spelling penny, dear, said he, remember it's the pen that's bad, don't blame the blame on me. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my